Hi, this is Ken McCarthy with Jazz on the Tube, and we're talking to Ed Pulser. And Ed and I share something. We went to the same school, and I read a letter he wrote to the Alumni Magazine. I said, that's a guy I want to meet because we're in the same zone. Ed is a trumpet player, a educator, and a jazz activist, and we're going to talk about his life in jazz. Welcome, Ed.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me to take part in this. Thank you.
Now, you're from the great city of Paterson, New Jersey. Is that right?
That is correct. It was when I grew up, it was the silk center of the world, silk mills in Paterson. That was the industrial city, yes.
Wow. And then, and I know you share that place with Bucky Pizzarelli, was born there?
Yes. The only other prominent jazz musician I know that came from that area, Mickey Gravine, was a trombone player who came from that area also. But Bucky's wife came from the same town in Hungary that my father came from. So obviously there was immigration of that particular town to the Paterson area somewhere around the turn of the century. So it was a real coincidence there. Yes.
Wow. Wow. So when did you first get exposed to jazz? When did you first hear it? And when did you realize you loved it?
Okay. basically, as a child, I didn't know much about jazz. I mean, I started playing the xylophone when I was 4 years old. And then my father, who was an amateur trumpet player, got me to start playing the trumpet when I was like in fifth grade or so, or in grammar school. And it was a great music program, even a grammar school, elementary school band. And I was really programmed to become a classical trumpet player. I was playing pretty well. I was playing things like Carnival of Venice with the Paterson Civic Band and all this. But I got to high school, and a guy who became a friend of mine who's a drummer who was in his third year in high school recognized that I was a good trumpet player. And I wasn't in school but 2 or 3 months, and he came to me and said, how would you like to play in my jazz band? And I said, okay. So there I was, about 13 years old. And his father had been a big band player, and I don't think prominent, but he had several arrangements. And what we'd meet once a week at this fellow's house, and we put together a 6-piece, quote, Dixieland band. And I got schooled by the father and the son in the joys of small band collective improvisation. They were great fans of Eddie Condon and that Chicago and New York style jazz. So we'd listen to he'd have us listen to a record every week, or give us a combo work, and we'd learn a new tune each week. So in a space of a school year of, let's say, 40 weeks, we had a repertoire of 40 tunes. And I never turned around. I remember my father and my trumpet teacher both literally crying when I told them I was going to play jazz. I like jazz. They thought I was going to be a classical musician. So that's how I got started.
Wow. Wow. So you got hooked in high school.
Well, it was the music of the time. We were playing for dances. People were jitterbugging to us. And there was a resurgence of classic jazz in the 50s. And I remember listening on the radio, Ted Husing's Bandstand every Saturday. We'd listen any feature. This band from Princeton called Stan Reuben and his Tiger Sound 5. And so that's one of the few things I knew about Princeton, that and Dick Kazmaier being a great All-American football player. But I didn't know Princeton from being prestigious Ivy League or any of that stuff. So when I got a scholarship to Princeton, that was when I thought I wanted to be discovered by Stan Reuben. And I was actually discovered by another guy, freshman week in college, and I ended up playing with another band as well. So. But that's it. That's the thing that seduced me in the 50s to being a musician.
Yeah. So when you were 13, it would have been 1950, more or less.
Yes. Right.
And this is pre rock and roll.
Right.
So jazz was the popular music of the time.
Yes, I mean, I remember at Princeton also, every club on the street had jazz bands all the entire time I was there through my graduation in 1958. And every college on the East Coast, we pretty much played every one of them for football weekends, house party weekends, and whatever. Excuse me. So right up until the year I graduated, jazz was predominant, and it was like, I think, 1956 when Bill Haley and Rock Around the Clock became popular in high school. So by the time those kids reached college, the next year after 58, I went back the next year, and there wasn't a jazz band on campus. It was all rock.
No kidding. So, it happened that fast.
It happened that fast. As soon as the high school kids hit college, they were into this. And kind of the ironic thing is Rock Around the Clock was a jitterbug tune. The drummer on that, Bill Haley and the Comets, the only thing rock about it was the name of the tune, Rock Around the Clock. It was a jitterbug tune, and the drummer was Cliff Lehman, who played with the Eddie Condon Jazz Band in New York. So, I mean, it's just kind of ironic.
Wow. So you had your own bands when you were in Princeton?
Yeah, well, what happened was freshman year, freshman orientation week. A week before college started, they had all the freshmen there, you know, and I don't know if they still do it, but I was bound and determined to be discovered by Stan Rubin. So I was in my room, but I put my hi-fi or my stereo, whatever we called it at the time, full blast, playing a jazz thing, and I opened the window and started playing jazz. And this is almost storybook material. I get a knock on the door, and I was hoping, you know, Stan would discover me. I mean, and knocking on the door was Dennis Brady. He was the class of 56 or something like that. And he had this other band, the Nassau Jazz Band, and he asked, he said, well, you want to play in our band? I said, sure. And the trumpet player in his band was the president of the senior class, and he kicked the president of the senior class out of the band and made me trumpet player. And Stan was the senior, Stan Rubin. It was 1955. And 54, 55, my freshman year. And used to hear Stan playing at the Student Center, which was the old Chancellor Green Building Library. Stan had been to Europe once or twice on Holland-America Lines student ships before airlines became the mode of travel to Europe. They had these wonderful student ships. Holland-America Line was bringing these packet steamers from the East Indies or the West Indies, and there'd be 900 students and 40 chaperones going over to Europe on a 9-day trip to Europe. And we got, Stan promoted our band. They called it Stan Rubin's Nassau Jazz Band. He had been over with the Tiger Town 2 years running. And so we got to play going to Europe after my freshman year. So I knew Stan. I didn't play with his regular band too much at college. And then It was the next April or so that I got the invitation to play at Grace Kelly's wedding, and he asked me to go with him. He wanted a legitimate Princetonian in the band at the time. So, and he had already graduated. Yeah, his band was not consisting of Princetonians, all Princetonians at that time. So he was out of school, a professional musician. So I got to twice by the time of my sophomore year, I've had two trips to Europe. So that, if anything, seduced me to become a musician, I think it was all of these things.
That's an amazing start. So Stan Rubin already had a reputation, even as a student. His orchestra already had a reputation that you had heard about it in New Jersey.
There was a program on WNEW, the one New York radio station, every Saturday morning called Ted Husing's Bandstand, and he'd feature big band stuff. And almost every week he'd stick in one tune by this wonderful jazz band from Princeton, Stan Rubin and his Tiger Town 5. And Stan obviously had promotion. He was the best promoter at the time. There were other good college bands, Eli's Chosen Six from Yale and the Spring Street Stompers from Williams. They were a great band. And so Stans was just one of many, but he was the promoter, and he became the kind of the leader of the whole Ivy League jazz band thing. He rented out Carnegie Hall a couple of Thanksgiving weekends, and he'd have an all-day jazz festival there, bringing in the Harvard, the Yale, Eli's Chosen Six, the Spring Street Stompers. There was another one from RPI. And we'd each have an hour to play, and the thing lasted like 7 hours on a Saturday afternoon of Thanksgiving weekend. So Dan was already promoting, so I don't doubt that he did a lot of promoting to get Fed Husing show, you know. So,
wow, and you played in one of those Carnegie Hall concerts.
Yes, with the Nassau Jazz Band, yes.
Wow. Now, you had there was a possibility of you becoming a professional baseball player.
Yes, that was my first love. I'm laughing because I'm still a baseball fan. In fact, I had my St. Louis Cardinal hat on this morning. It was raining here, so I wore it. Yeah, that was my first love. I almost played in the first Little League World Series. When they talked about having a Little League, they were just starting Little League. We played in a development league. I was like 12 years old roughly. And the coach of our team decided to put an all-star team together of players from all the teams in the league. And we practiced all summer long, and then at the last minute we were rejected because we were not a set team. We were a bunch of all-stars, so we didn't get to play at the first Little League World Series. And then when I got to Hawthorne High School, I lived in actually a suburb of Patterson, Prospect Park. I played shortstop and third base. I made varsity my freshman year. And when I got to Princeton, I had to try out with the Dodgers after graduating from Hawthorne. It was in Brooklyn. The Dodgers were still playing in Ebbets Field, and
wow.
And our team had won the Bergen Passaic League Championship, I think, that year. So I and about two others of my team and a few others in the league were invited to the tryouts. And I was good field, mediocre hit. So the guy running the camp, Al Campanis, who was the traveling secretary for the Dodgers, he and I had a conversation. He said, what are your plans? I said, well, I have a scholarship to Princeton. He said, take it. Get a good hitting coach and come and see me in 4 years. and coincidentally, I would have made varsity at Princeton sophomore in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the year Stan Rubin played at Grace Kelly's wedding, and that occurred in April. So I had to choose, and I gave up baseball and took music as my way. So,
hey,
have
you had a chance to get down to Cuba yet?
Never. I've never been to Cuba. No. I would find that very interesting to have a chance to go. Yes.
The reason I bring it up is Cuba is practically baseball is practically a state religion in Cuba.
Oh, I know. That I know. Yes.
And what I discovered on my last trip there is they have bands. I mean, they're not jazz bands. They're more conga Afro-Cuban bands.
Right.
Of fans. They bring their trombones and their trumpets and their drums and their cowbells, and they play and dance through the entire game, all nine innings. it's
beautiful.
It's really a scene. Now a lot of people, when they graduate from Princeton, they become, you know, doctors or lawyers or captains of industry, but you were heading for a jazz career. So what happened when you got out of school?
Well, it didn't happen automatically. I'll make another long story short.
Okay.
Back in those days, I was good in math and physics, and the way to really make a career for yourself was to get into engineering. So I studied engineering, basically mechanical engineering at Princeton, and got a Bachelor of Science in Engineering. And Meanwhile, I've been always, I kept playing trumpet a couple nights a week, et cetera, and I took a job. I spent 3 years in the Air Force after I was in ROTC, and after I got out of the Air Force, I worked in engineering for a while, then I got into purchasing, and it took 13 years before I went into music full time, so it was not something that happened automatically.
Okay.
So it was 1973, so... Yeah, 15 years out of Princeton when Benny Goodman called me to play with him. And I figured if I'm that good, maybe I've got a good shot at the full time. And then I packed in my day career, my day job, and we went into music full time.
Wow. Oh. Wow. So what, yep, go ahead.
No, it's just, that period in my life was very productive musically in that I was living in New Jersey at the time, and a lot of work. There were a lot of good players in New York who were out of work, and I could get them to come to New Jersey and play concerts. And I was sort of the host band leader for New Jersey Jazz Society, and I'd get these great players to come out and play with them: Joe Venuti, Teddy Wilson, Bobby Hackett, Vic Dickinson, Gene Krupa. I mean, it was amazing, and I had a chance to play with all these guys. And it was Bobby Hackett who returned the favor when he couldn't make a certain tour with Benny Goodman in 1973, and he recommended me to Benny. And that's how I got to play, 8 months, I guess, was it, I toured with Benny, and that was my Benny Goodman career. It was 8 months.
But you had some amazing band members. We talked about Bucky Pizzarelli. He was in that band, right?
Bucky, in 1973, was on guitar. John Bunch was on piano. Either Zoot Sims or Al Klink on sax. George Masso, it was his first time with Benny, trombone player from Providence, Rhode Island. And Bucky was on guitar, and Slam Stewart was on bass. And various drummers, but Benny went through about four different drummers in the course of that year. He was very, I can't say particular or persnickety about drummers. He was very, very definite bass in drummers. And so, and Peter Appleyard was on Vibe. So it was really like a non-tet rather than a set. He called it a sextet, but he had, two reed players. He had a guitar player and he had a Vibe player. So there were three extra players.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Did that band tour a lot?
It was all touring, and it was all small band. It was not no charts. It was just improvised. Yeah, I didn't take account of how many gigs. Probably in the 8 months I was there, there were probably 20, 25 gigs or so like that. It wasn't a band on the road. He could book separately for concerts.
Sure. And you say no charts. He called the tune and everybody found their way?
Yep. He'd talk a little bit before the concert and say, I'd like to do these tunes, and if anybody had any objections or anything, or you don't know them or anything like that. But it was a sort of an interesting time because the trumpet player or cornet player, which I was playing at the time, I still play cornet, in a combo like that, has to play lead, and the other ones are playing around them. And here I am in a Benny Goodman sextet, and Benny actually... I had to play a definitive lead for the band. We weren't following Benny leading it, but I used to use a bucket mute, which has cotton in it, which softens the tone of the horn so I wouldn't overblow Benny. And at the same time, I could still play with enthusiasm. So it was a very interesting experience.
Did they do any recordings? Did anybody record any of their shows?
No, I'm sure that a few informal things were done, but no, nothing. In fact, a friend of mine, Sandy Maxwell from Princeton, was in the audience on one of my concerts at the New Jersey Garden State Arts Center, and he recorded it. So, but it's poorly recorded. Benny, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
Well, as far as recording with Benny. Benny had one instance where he invited us up to his house, and I guess it was Stamford, Connecticut. He had a house there. And he said, I want to rehearse. And so we go up there, and George Masso, trombone player, had just written about three or four arrangements of some of the contemporary tunes of the time. I remember Benny liked the show A Little Night Music. And among other tunes, he had arrangements, Send in the Clowns. And so we would rehearse this stuff, and Benny had a guy sitting there with a tape recorder, and he was recording all of his stuff. And so I said, here's my chance. I'm finally going to get to be recorded by Benny Goodman, or with Benny Goodman. And we finally get one of the tunes, I forget which one, down perfectly after three takes. We said, yeah, and then, that's it. And the guy, he ran out of tape halfway through the tune. Benny, I'm sorry, tape ran out. So here was Benny. It was informal. I wouldn't want to say Benny was, the word cheap comes to mind, but I don't mean that, but he was very close to the vest financial matters, and he probably hired this guy just to tape the thing, and the guy ran out of tape halfway through. So that was my one instance.
You know, I sympathize with people that have a band, you know, that they're taking around, and you know, the logistics of it can be a challenge, and part of the reason that doesn't exist as much as it used to. Actually, let's talk about something that the letter that you wrote I read that, you know, how
right.
we met. You made a really interesting point, and we do, especially in September, back to school, we do a lot of highlighting, especially of high school bands. And there seems to be a renaissance of high school big band jazz. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't remember this many when I was growing up, and I certainly don't remember them being this good. And, of course, that continues over into college. There's a lot of college programs that have big bands. And I can see the logistical reason for it. You got 40 kids in the program. They all want to play. Have them all play together at once, you know. But you made an interesting point about a direction you think that college jazz education should be going in. Would you talk about that a little bit?
Okay, I'll try to be as brief as I can again. But I've always been a good a proponent of classic jazz, which you might can call traditional swing mainstream. It has not been, I have neither delved much into big band, and I haven't delved much into bebop, because I realized that the music I was playing and the music that I believed in had the possibility of being popular over the long haul. And it's certainly proven itself to be the case, is that people in general, first off, nobody can afford a big band anymore. So, I mean, that's almost out of the picture. Nobody, the public is not interested in, they don't even understand big band instrumentals. Singers have become the forefront ever since World War II. Okay, so you need vocals. So it's a dead end to put big band stuff. You're introducing people to jazz. That's wonderful. The Stan Kenton Band is the one that started it, I believe, in college, starting, quote, jazz education. And they found that the only way you could justify, as you said, the course was to have a big band with arrangements. And the poor guys who are sitting in that band are thinking they're playing jazz, and they might just as well be playing polkas. For all of the swing that they can hear in a section, you can't hear it. You can't hear what the big picture is. And not only that, you don't have any chance to improvise.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens, guys come out of school all gung-ho, they've majored in jazz, and jazz is wonderful. And they find out, they get on the street trying to find work. And the only work that is still available is small band classic jazz, where you get 4, 5, 6, 7 musicians, mostly, not more than that, because most of the clubs can't afford anything more than that. And these are where your gigs are. And lo and behold, all of a sudden you're put in a situation where you've got to follow some of the rules of classic jazz. You're not playing a solo all the time. You're listening to what the others are doing. And if you don't have this experience coming out of college, you're lost. I've seen so many guys have come up to me when I'm busking on the street in New Orleans or in New York, and they learn more than 2 weeks working out here in the street than they did in 4 years in college about the real world. So,
yeah.
So that's what prompted my comment that, oh, yes, again. And I know it mentioned in the article that he was the instructor, his name escapes me, but was going to talk about going back to Thelonious Monk. And I made another comment. I said, wait a minute, back to Thelonious Monk? what happened to all this basic stuff? Louis Armstrong, Benny Goodman, the stuff that is endured, the stuff that the public can understand.
Right. Yeah. And there's certainly room for both. I mean, but if it comes down to, am I going to be able to play for a living, or am I even going to be able to be in a band that's active? Maybe somebody's got another profession, but they want to play. If they want to be in a band that's active and in front of the public a lot, they're going to do a lot better with the kind of music you described. And that's not to say they can't do other stuff, but in terms of just finding their way commercially and their way in front of audiences, I think your point's really, really well taken. You mentioned busking, and people might be surprised that someone with your experience, you know, has fun going out on the street and playing for the passing crowd.
I'll tell you, it fits completely with my whole thinking of it's personal music. It's me playing for you, just the two of us. And I'm on street level with eye contact and seeing people dancing to a rhythm in front of me. It's wonderful. It's absolutely fantastic. In fact, with the low rate of pay at some of the jazz clubs now, I can make, you know, people, if I needed the money, I could make more money busking on a street in New Orleans than I could playing in a jazz club. you manufacture some amateur quality CDs and you sell them for $10. They cost you $1, and you sell them for $10. People want to go home with a souvenir of New Orleans, so they, oh, I want, oh, let's, I'll buy your CDs. So immediately you got a guy going to tip you $27 out of, he buys three CDs and 27 of it goes to the band. So, you know.
Not bad.
It's enjoyable. It really is enjoyable, and it's non-pressured too.
I'm guessing that you've played on Royal Street.
Yes, in New Orleans, I've bussed on Royal Street. Loose Marbles, which is one of the first bands to go down with my son, who plays trumpet in New Orleans. He and Michael Magro almost were responsible in a lot of for starting this resurgence of classic jazz back in New Orleans. I mean, this goes back 10, 12 years ago when they moved down there, and that was the first of the bands that was dedicated to Bunk Johnson and a whole bunch of other stuff, and they played on the street. And now all the young kids, well, aside from the ones who are coming down playing country and that kind of stuff, Royal Street has got two or three bands playing traditional jazz there. So the young people are hopefully rediscovering it. So I don't know. I guess I went far afield on that one. But anyway.
Oh, no, not at all. No, not at all. I mean, it really is interesting. I've been going to New Orleans pretty steadily since 2006. And for a couple of years there, I was spending the whole winter down there. And if you're in New Orleans, you see how enjoyable and popular the old time, quote, old time music is.
Yeah.
For young people, they're not going there for to watch a museum piece. They're having fun. They're dancing. They're digging it. And that's so encouraging to see that. It's very natural. It's very spontaneous. It's part of the scene, and they just jump right in.
It also occurs in New York. I mean, busking in Washington Square or in a subway station at Union Square, and playing in the hangouts of where the young people are in Brooklyn and Queens and Lower Manhattan, and you see people dancing to it, which is another thing—the interaction of dancing with the playing. The thing is, when you're a musician, you don't. I can't speak for every musician, but you don't like somebody putting a label on what kind of music you're playing. Oh, this is post-bop, this is pre-bop, this is funk, this is it. Most musicians say, look, I'm just playing music. Just let's listen to it. I'm a musician. And when you're going out there, if you like playing classic jazz, every time I walk on a bandstand, I think I'm playing cutting edge. I defy anybody to tell me I am not playing cutting edge jazz every time. You know, so, and you're just enjoying it. And the collective improvisation that goes on in classic jazz is something that's gone down the tubes with a lot of more modern playing. Nobody's playing collective. The horns don't know what to do collectively. They're not carrying on a conversation. They're playing solos all the time. So
Right. You know, it's okay. Now it's your turn to solo. Now it's your turn to solo. And actually it is very advanced for everyone to solo at once. I mean, some of the most avant-garde jazz musicians, you know, like for instance, Ornette Coleman, that's something that he was working on with his musicians all the time. And that goes right back to the origin of the music.
You're having a musical conversation. You're listening to what others are doing. You're trying to make the whole come out better than the sum of the parts in a way. Tuba Skinny is a great example in New Orleans right now. They're doing a lot of collective improvisation. And the soloist becomes the prominence of the soloist becomes secondary to the collective. It's wonderful.
Yeah, they're doing great, and they started on Royal Street.
Yeah, they still are busking. I mean, the last time I was down there a month or two ago, they're still busking on Royal Street, and they're now going all over the country with concerts. People are discovering them.
I think they had a tour in Australia, a couple of years ago.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just an example, but there's other stuff that's going on there. I mean, my son, Ben Pulser, has been leading bands at the Spotted Cat for 8 or 10 years, the Orleans Six and the Grinders and a few other names. They all got to come up with names for these bands, but he's working 8 to 10 gigs a week down there, I mean, and playing classic jazz. So it's wonderful. New Orleans and New York are both wonderful places to experience jazz.
Yeah, jazz as a living thing, not as a something separate that you take out of the closet every now and then, but something that's just out there all the time. I love New Orleans in particular because, you know, if somebody has a wedding, they're going to hire a jazz band. If they
Correct.
Have a party,
right.
you know, it's just it's part of life. If they're going to have a picnic, they're going to hire a jazz band. If they're going to open a store, they're going to have a brass
right.
band out front. It's really wonderful. Let's go back in history. Well, actually, before we go there, I want to say this. I think it's important, and I think you probably agree with me. Just because the music was popular in the 20s and 30s doesn't mean that it's not cutting edge anymore. I mean, you know, quality is cutting edge. So to say that, well, now we need something that's up to date. Well, you know, something that's very good and very sophisticated, just because it has had its origins in the 20s and 30s and 40s, doesn't mean that it's outdated. It's not like in a car that, you know, looks mm-hmm. too. You know what I mean? I think more and more people are coming to grasp that. I think that the rock and roll thing was like a sledgehammer to the culture and it just swamped everything else. And I think there was a time, especially let's say in the 60s and 70s and maybe even in the little 80s, where to listen to old jazz was, you know, just considered retrograde, you know, something that, you know, was ridiculous. But I think the younger people who are coming up now, they don't have that feeling. Like if the music's good and they're having a good time and they can dance to it, they're in. You know, mm-hmm. they're not saying, "Oh, I can't like this because it's my parents' music or my grandparents' music." If it's good, it's good to them. And then one other thing about I wanted to say,
yes, okay. yes, and yes. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I know I'm preaching to the choir on that one. Another thing about music and dance, you know, it's only a relatively recently that somehow music and dance occasionally have been separated. Bringing up Cuba again, if you go to Cuba, there is no such thing as a music performance that doesn't involve audience dancing. Now, they may not dance from the beginning. They may sit and listen for a while. But once the band heats up, everybody gets on their feet and is dancing, whether it's rumba or son or mambo mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever the form is. Eventually, the audience gets on their feet. And I think if you look at human history for thousands of years, I mean, I wasn't around thousands of years ago, but my guess is music and dance were inseparable. In fact, I read recently that there are places in Africa where the word for music and the word for dance are the same word. They don't even separate the concepts in their mind. It's the same activity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But let's go back a little bit. You were the manager and co-owner of one of the great jazz clubs in New York City, Eddie Condon's.
Yes. Okay. Just one last thought on what saying. We're going to get into Condon's. But this is exactly the what I feel about it, is that it's a unified thing, that music is in every human being to some degree, and it does directly involve bodily movement, i.e. dance. It's part of the social fabric. It's also part of the social meeting of men and women and dancing together and hugging and getting a social contact. You see babies dancing in front of you. You see old people dancing. When they asked Louis Armstrong and Benny Goodman, what kind of music are you playing? They said, we're playing dance music. But here it is, right there. So,
it's been
a part of the human condition, and that's why it will never die. It may pale for a while, and it'll come full-fledged again. People are going to rediscover what was discovered 100 years ago, and they're not going to realize it was discovered 100 years ago. And I do think that part of the critics talking about jazz having to progress, it's like art. Oh, you can't paint realism anymore? What are you trying to tell me? And I do think that a lot of the more modern guys who are not so concerned about the rhythm created a gap between the audience and the playing. And this is the big battle between the classic jazz musicians and the boppers, was that the boppers, in effect, turned their back on the audiences. And what happened, rock came right in the middle and said, people want a beat. The minute rock came in, people gravitated because it had a beat. And there went jazz. Popularity of progressive modern jazz went right out the window. So those are observations I've had over the years about what happened.
Interesting. It makes a lot of sense. You know, another thing that happened around that period of rock and roll is the of course Cuba suddenly became forbidden.
I wasn't around.
But apparently in the 40s and 50s. Going to Cuba and enjoying the music there, and also going out in the city like places like the Palladium, there was a lot of Cuban and Afro-Latin dance music everywhere, and so that came to a screeching halt at the beginning of the 60s too. So you had maybe this perfect storm of one, the Latin music suddenly being guillotined in a sense, and then jazz going into a more modern direction, and suddenly, I mean, that's a really good point. Nature hates a vacuum, and rock and roll just went right into the vacuum and took over.
Yeah, simplistic blues. I mean, you pick up the guitar and you play three chords, and all of a sudden you can become a genius playing rock. I don't want to get too much on that, but that's simplistically, that's exactly what happened in the 60s. Why there was no more jazz at Princeton in 1959, a year after I got out. Is rock jumped in. Go ahead.
No, you mentioned something else too, that when you play, you see toddlers dancing or trying to dance, and you see their great grandparents on the same dance floor, all enjoying the same music, and that's a very positive thing. And by the way, that's something you'll also see in Cuba. There's this segregation of generations doesn't occur in music down there. And I think it's an unnatural segregation. And I think it's something, again, that happened in that strange time of the 60s and 70s, the promotion of the youth culture and everything else was obsolete. And I don't think it's good for society. Obviously, the different generations have different interests and different motivations based on where they are in life, of course, but we also want occasions where we're all together and not thinking about the age differences, you know, and I think that jazz. Yeah. So it's so.
My wife, for instance, loves to dance. She's also a very good vocalist. She sings very straight ahead, very wonderful, you know, a good vocalist. But she loves dancing. So she's out one or two nights a week swing dancing with some of the younger people here. And it doesn't matter. Yes, swing, the younger people gravitate to younger people because they're socially wanting to meet younger people. But still, she's comfortable dancing with a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old or a 60-year-old who knows how to dance. And so there is less of an age thing there than there is, you know, anyway, it encompasses everybody. You can read books, too, about the sociological, psychological effects of music on old, infirm people, how they don't react to anything else, but you play some music in front of them, all of a sudden they start smiling from their bed and start clicking their fingers and doing all kinds of stuff. That music resonates right up to the day you die. So,
it's an amazing force in life. Let's talk about Eddie Condon's. I mean, that's a legendary club, and I know from everybody that I know who's ever operated a jazz club, it is not an easy business. But you managed it and co-owned it for almost 10 years.
Basically, the story on that was, again, in the '60s, it was very difficult to book bands playing classic jazz. So my partner, Red Balaban, who came from the family of the Balaban and Katz movie theaters, Barney Balaban and theaters in the Midwest. He was a band leader of a band called Balaban and Katz, C-A-T-S, as opposed to Balaban and K-A-T-Z. So we're playing and trying to get our band booked all over New York. And then in the late 60s, early 70s, club owners were saying, you're ridiculous. We don't want to put your music into the club. And both of us had faith in the kind of music that we're talking about. Both of us were friends with Eddie Condon, the great jazz guitarist who came from Indiana, brought jazz from Chicago into New York. This whole thing that I'm talking about, 6, 7, 8-piece bands all improvising. So he came to New York, and they opened the club in 1945. In the Village, and called it Eddie Condon's, where they featured this kind of music. That club was eventually closed because NYU was putting up a dormitory, and they owned the property. So Condon moved uptown to East 56th Street, and so for years there was a second version of Eddie Condon. So 1973, and there was no Condon's anyway. So when came in the early 70s, out of frustration with booking our bands in some of the nightclubs in Manhattan, I think I scoured every club from 42nd Street up to 57th and got nowhere. Balaban said, I'm gonna open a club up. So we went, essentially he went to Phyllis Condon, Eddie Condon's widow, and said, look, we'd like to reopen a club and play in the same style that Eddie believed in. Could we use the name Eddie Condon's? And she said, sure. So he signed an agreement for $1 a year that as long as we presented roughly the same kind of music that Eddie believed in, we could run a club called Eddie Condon's. So we reopened Condon's in 1975. For the first 2 years, I was just a sideman in Red's band, and it was losing money. And I was telling Red how he should be able to manage the club, and he said, "Okay, before I go out of business, okay." He got rid of the prior manager, and he said, "You can manage it." And basically, I think with whatever smarts I learned at Princeton in the way of economics and all the rest of it, I turned the club around it began to show a profit. And then 2 years later, I went to him and I said, "Look, I don't really just want to be manager. I want to be part of the ownership." And so in 1979, he let me buy in over a period of time. So from 79 to 85, I was sideman, band leader, manager, and co-owner of Eddie Thomas. So, yes, and it's a very interesting experience. What the public doesn't know about the rigors of owning a nightclub in Manhattan, it isn't all that glamorous. I mean, you know, it's a lot of the music was glorious, and I mean, it was the highlight of my life for those 10 years playing there. I mean, if I were ever going to single out a 10-year period that I enjoyed the most, playing six nights a week, five and 6 hours a night playing at that club, and every person in the world came into that club. So it was wonderful, a wonderful life. But the running of it was another thing.
Yeah,
the business end of music. That's another thing I think is lacking in a lot of college jazz music majors. They don't get enough of the business side of music. And I told my son, I'd rather he majored in business and minored in music, because business, you know, important. Anyway, so it was a very interesting experience.
Where was that club located?
We reopened it on West 54th Street, right next to where the Hilton Hotel is, between 6th and 7th Avenue. One of the reasons we opened there was Jimmy Ryan's had relocated from Swing Street, from 52nd Street, and they were operating on 54th Street, and this club became available three doors down, and we figured, well, we'll try to create another mini Swing Street. So both of us, both Ryan's and Condon's, actually thrived because people could go to one club and, okay, let's have a couple drinks here, let's go to the other club. And so we created our mini Swing Street on West 54th Street.
Almost like a mini Frenchman Street.
Yeah, right. And that's another wonderful, glorious happening down there. That's unbelievable. But anyway, there's so many stories. I mean, location in New York. We were near 20 hotels were in that area, so we'd advertise in hotels. Coming here, jazz just around the corner, no cover, and $10 minimum or whatever we put on. So people would come in from out of town, and they could walk out of their hotel room, walk over to Condon's, have a couple of drinks, and walk home, you know. So we had out-of-towners, and we had every musician in New York used to hang there. We gave special prices to musicians for drinks, whether you played there or not. Whether you're just a musician, you come in and you could get a double Remy Martin on the rocks for a buck and a quarter, and all you had to do was be a musician. So people began to realize that they could see musicians hanging in the club, so it was, as well as playing there, so it was a happening.
That wasn't, now, didn't Woody Allen play in one of the Manhattan clubs for a while?
He played in Michael's Pub, which was on the east
Michael's,
side.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's another subject which I don't want to get into. Okay, I'm in a positive mood right now. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay. No problem. Hey, now you've been music director of a bunch of jazz festivals. What does it mean to be a music director of a jazz festival?
Okay, jazz party as opposed to festival thing. Whether they call it festival or not, there's a difference between a jazz party and a jazz festival. And what basically I've been involved in were jazz parties. This is where a host would throw a party. It started out with somebody just bringing a band out to play at a house someplace, like in Colorado or Texas or something. And a couple of places got so popular that they became annual affairs. And not only would they invite a band, let's say the Condon band, they'd invite 10 or 12 or 15 musicians to come out. And when you have them out playing for a weekend, you've got to put together the musicians in different combinations during the weekend. You're not using organized bands, so you end up inviting, for, let's make it simple, two trumpets, two reed players, two trombones, two guitars, two pianos, two basses and two drums, and a vibe player and a vocalist. Okay, so you got 15 people or something like that. And a musical director will take each night. The parties usually last Friday night, Saturday afternoon, Saturday night, Sunday afternoon. And each is of, like, say, a four-hour segment, which contains four or five sets. And so what you do is put the bands together in different combinations. You'll put a traditional band, then you'll have a Benny Goodman swing group, then you'll put a trio, then you'll feature a piano player, a soul playing soul, and then you'll bring back a 10-piece band. So in other words, the chemistry of putting the musicians together, and this is what a musical director does. And you also
so
can go ahead.
It's like programming.
Yeah. But it takes the knowledge of each player's ability, who's going to get along musically together. And you do have an occasion to recommend a few players to the people who are hosting the party, but it's really their choice who they want to invite out each year. So it's the role of the musical director to take what he's given and make it work.
There's a guy named Jim Igo, E-I-G-O, who's a longtime record producer, or record promoter, and jazz promoter in New York City. Anyway, he showed me or sent me the link for the Colorado Springs Jazz Party. Somebody had made a documentary years ago, and we've played it on Jazz on the Tube, and people love it, and it's amazing. Was that something that you were involved in?
Well, I don't know where the video was, whether it was done with the current version of Colorado Springs. Colorado Springs has been running their party for 25 or 30 years. I've become musical director here only the last 6 or 7 years. So I don't know whether I was involved with that thing. But basically, that's the essence of it. Colorado Springs was one of the earliest. Odessa, Texas, believe it or not. West Texas was another one. Denver, Colorado, those were the originators. Now they have them in Atlanta, Cleveland, a whole bunch of other places, the jazz parties. So that was, that was what, if you saw that, that's basically essentially what it is, yeah.
It was amazing, the lineup of people that came to that event to play. And yeah, the word party is a good word for it because, the music's tremendous, but it feels like a party.
It is a party. They started out being a party for and with musicians. It started out simply where the guy's house, he invited the musicians as their guests. He invited a couple of his friends to come over, and they partied together. The original Texas party that I played at in Odessa was a 6-day affair. You'd get finished playing 4 hours, and somebody would invite you over to their house, and they'd throw a party that lasted until 3 a.m. Then you'd get up at 8 o'clock, and you'd play at one of the local schools for the school kids, and then you'd go out and play that night again and another party the next night. It was a party. Yes.
Wow. And are these operated like businesses or nonprofits or just money losers, or how do they work? I imagine it varies.
First off, they don't exist if they lose money. So they're constantly trying to create different things to attract local people as well as traveling. Things change over the years. There used to be a lot of groupies that travel at all of these jazz parties. They go to all of them, and airline travel has and age and those people have worked against that kind of thing. So the best successful parties attract local people as well as the travelers. I don't know what your question.
Everyone may.
I'm sure that one or two of them have a sugar daddy or two who makes up the difference whether they're going to lose money or whether they're going to stay in existence. I don't think any of them make an awful lot of money. They're not in it for a profit. I think they're in with the goal is to come out ahead on this thing and have a great party each year,
And now they started out in people's homes. Are they? I've never been to one. So, are they now in bigger venues? Are tickets sold? How does it work?
Yeah, most of them are. If you could Google a lot of this stuff on the internet. If you just looked up Colorado Springs Jazz Party or West Texas Jazz Party, or some of the other ones, San Diego Jazz Party. Those are ones I'm directly involved in still. And you can buy patrons tickets for the weekend. They're usually now held at hotels, which makes it convenient for the guests as well as the musicians. We get housed in a hotel, and they usually are occurring in a hotel situation. And again, it's not a festival, for instance. We'll invite 15 or 20 bands and pay them hardly any money, so that people who are going to play them are not making much money. You have a lot of amateur bands, and you got a lot of amateur fans out there who follow a given band. So in a given weekend, they might have six or seven venues over in a town where people can go hear whoever they want. And but they're all organized bands. There's very little in the way of what I'm describing is an all-star band, really putting together guys from all over the country. The only time they get to play with some of these people is at these guys' parties.
Got it.
So the jazz party, you have one location to hear it, and jazz festivals, you usually are flooded with all kinds of choices where you want to go and spend your time.
One of the things we do at Jazz on the Tube is we have a directory, an international directory of all the jazz festivals all over the world, all the jazz clubs all over the world, all the jazz mm-hmm. radio stations, but we don't have a list of all the jazz parties because honestly, until you and I talked, I didn't realize that this was a thing. I thought the Colorado Springs Jazz Party was a one-off. I didn't realize this was an ongoing event, so we're going to add a new category. I might send you the list that we generate and see if we've left anybody off.
Well, what I think you should do, that I'd recommend to you, the Syncopated Times as the Bible of classic jazz. You ought to, Andy Senior, he lives, I think, in Utica, but if you Googled syncopatedtimes.com, it's a monthly publication, and in it, it's full of the jazz festivals, the jazz party listings, and you could glean half of this information from there. There's a column also on all the jazz clubs in New York that are operating. A picture is worth a thousand words, but it comes out of upstate New York, just like where I don't know what town you're in, Hudson or wherever.
I'm near Hudson. I'm in Tivoli. Yeah, it's not now. Utica's not far, but I'll find it. Yeah, thanks for reminding me about that. Hey, the place where I'd like to end with this is, you know, not only have you had this experience playing and running a club and being musical director for jazz parties, traveling the world, but you're also involved in education. And before we started the recording, you were talking about your involvement at the Louis Armstrong House. And for people that don't know, who've never been or didn't even know there was a Louis Armstrong House, could you talk a little about what it is and then talk a little bit about what you are doing there to make the experience interesting for the kids?
Okay. Basically, the Louis Armstrong House Museum is the house that Louis and Lucille, his fourth wife, lived in. It was the last house he lived in and that she lived in their life. It's in Corona, Corona, Queens, New York. It's one of the five boroughs of New York. And he lived there for 28 years. They moved in 1943, and he died in 1971. And she lived there another 12 years after him until she passed away. And the house is, she set up a foundation, and it was taken over, it was assigned to Queens College in New York that they as the administrators of the foundation, and the house has been preserved perfectly the way it was when she died. She made a few minor changes after he died, but it's the last house that they lived in. And currently, a fundraising to construct across the street a major museum of the Louis Armstrong, because we discovered that he, along with all his other archives, which now are housed at Queens College, he had recorded 700 reels of tape in his house alone every time somebody would come in. This is stuff that nobody knows. And so there is once every hour, there is a tour of the house, and it's not a large house, but it's amazing because it's how a great person lived very simply. He was in the public eye 10 months a year, and he'd come back from his tours and he just relaxed in this house. It's quite an experience to be in this house. We play a couple of the tapes of him talking with Lucille and things, and you're there with when they were there. So my role, I started out just volunteering because I have had a little more time on my hands the last couple of years. I started volunteering as a regular volunteer docent tour guide. I realized that we were bringing in more and more tours of students from the local schools, grades 2 through high school. I mean, it's incredible. And there was a definite need, I felt, an opportunity where I could reach these kids of all ages, introduce them to the sound of a horn, to jazz, to play on a trumpet and a cornet. Half of them haven't even heard the sound of a trumpet or a cornet played in the room
with
them. And there's only room in the house for, like, say, 10 to 15 people on a given tour. The house is not large. So if the class comes in with 20 to 30 students, there's half of them, we split them up. And in the past, I gave them little quizzes while you waited for the other tour to just get moving through the house. And I realized that I'd have about a 20-25 minute time frame where I could be talking with students, introducing them to music and jazz, like getting questions. So I'd show them how to play the trumpet, how to play the cornet, and I'd show them 6 different mutes. I'd get them scat singing, and if I had enough time, I could let one or two of them try to play one of the trumpets that's there. These are either my horn, Priya Schoenberg, another jazz trumpeter. She left a trumpet there. So it's an interactive thing with the students. And then, you know, when the second group comes down after going through the house, I get them and I go through my whole thing again. So today there was just one class of third graders. Tomorrow there's a class at 10:30, the class of third graders. And then at 11:30, there are eighth grade band is coming through. So I got third graders and eighth graders tomorrow. And it's exciting for me passing along this music to young people.
It's wonderful. The idea that a child would never have heard a trumpet before, I mean, it's so obvious. But if somebody doesn't show it to them in this day and age, how could they ever know? So what a great thing to see the music instrument. Yeah. How wonderful.
So anyway, I instituted this thing about a year and a half or 2 years ago. And I even get seniors sometimes who want to hear, and they'll come in while I'm conducting a class for young ones, and they'll come in and they'll ask the questions too, because half of them don't know what the heck's going off anyway, you know, general public. So anyway, it's a nice role, and I feel very thrilled myself. I get as much out of passing it along to young people. I mean, with the older guys who welcomed me to the jazz field when I was in high school, and I feel that it's payback time as well, you know, and it also, it's great. It's fun.
And what a great spot to be doing it. There's a beautiful picture, I'm sure you've seen it, of Louis Armstrong sitting, it looks like on the front steps of his house, playing trumpet, surrounded by kids.
With the little kids, yeah. I mean, there's loads of stories like that.
It's a wonderful thing, and that's how the music gets passed down. Somebody's got to help them see the potential in it and the joy in it. So if people want to follow your work, I know you've got a website.
Yes, I have a website, but I don't really update it with gigs and all that stuff. Half of the gigs I'm getting now, I'm getting called by 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds on last-minute basis to sub. So I don't really list. I don't keep up on where to find me. But, I mean, people could, when they come to New York, they could always contact me through the website, you know, or at edpulser@gmail.com. And find out when they come to town where this is going, you know, where this is happening. My website, it gives a nice cross-section of who I've been and who I am, but it's not good for promoting what gigs I'm doing.
Okay. But that's a nice invitation. We do have a lot of very passionate and serious jazz fans, and so if anybody's going to New York and want to see what's going on where, you can go to Ed's site. It's Ed Pulser, PolcerE.com. EdPulser.com.
Right. EdPulser.com. Or they can email me, EdPulser@gmail.com.
Okay.
Either way, I welcome them, as did Louis Armstrong. He'd answer letters from anybody, whether he knew them or not. He would just love people, and I kind of, he's a role model to me, so.
Wow.
Whatever time I have left, I'd like to do it positively like this.
Well, what a great life in jazz. It's been great hearing your story, and I hope we get to meet sometime.
Come on to New York. I'll give you a private tour of the Louis Armstrong house.
Oh, that would be awesome. Oh, you know, I might bring my nephew. Oh, my God. I have a nephew who's a really good flute player. He's 10. He's really good.
Uh-huh.
He used to like jazz when he was a baby, and now somehow he's gotten the idea that only classical music is good. So, I keep, you know, trying to. He's gone in the opposite direction as you.
No, that's all right.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he'll come around someday. But I think if he came and saw Louis Armstrong's house and you know, got to see you on the trumpet, that might change his mind. And then you spend part of your year in New Orleans, is that right?
Yeah, well, we, for a long time, my wife and I owned a condo down there because Ben, our youngest son, lives there and plays there. We sold it about a year and a half ago. Going back and forth didn't prove too much. New York musicians would assume I was in New Orleans, and New Orleans musicians would assume I'm in New York. So it didn't preserve, you know. But both cities are really, I don't know of any two cities where classic jazz is shown to the best possible in the best possible way. New York and New Orleans are the two places in the United States where they really appreciate this music. Yes, so we go down, and in fact, my wife is leaving tomorrow to go for 4 days. They're having the French Quarter Fest this weekend, so she's going down to visit Ben and dance in the French Market and et cetera, with the swing dancers. So she's going down for 4 days, 5 days.
Oh, what fun. And that French Quarter Fest has become a monster in the positive sense. My God. I subscribe to Offbeat, and so I get it's the magazine of music in Louisiana. And,
yeah, I know Offbeat, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm reading through the lineup for this free festival. If the people don't know about it, the French Quarter Festival is one of the great festivals on earth, and it's all free. And you need a lot of stamina because the shows start early and they go late, and there's like 8 or 10 stages, and it goes for days. It's really a beautiful thing.
And it's really New Orleans music. The Jazz and Heritage Festival has become more of a high profile, except for the economy event. There's not that much that is significantly New Orleans. So the French Quarter Fest presents New Orleans music in all its glory. And the New Orleanians and people down there prefer the French Quarter Fest. And in fact, I think it's now approaching, or if it has already outdrawn the Jazz Fest in New Orleans.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
The quality is definitely there, and you're right. It gives the local musicians a spotlight. Well, Ed, thank you so much for this time. We love to talk with people who've had devoted their lives to the music, and you have done it in a lot of different ways as a musician, ongoing club owner, music director, introducing the music to kids. It's really great. And people that want to read more about you, and there's a clip there just so they can see videos and listen to some of your music. It's all at Ed Pulser, edpolcer.com. And Ed, on behalf of everybody here at Jazz on the Tube, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for considering talking to me and letting me expound on all of this. It's great talking with you.